And stay tuned for Juno Afternoon. We'll talk with Kristen McTeague and George Reifenstein about a Helping Hands event. We'll learn about an upcoming Tai Chi class. It's Thursday, so we'll have Arts Up with Megan Garrison of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, and UAS Chancellor Rick Caulfield will be here to highlight graduation. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more live at 3 on a Juno Afternoon. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Winslow, Arizona Police Department has hired a new chief of police in the wake of the shooting death of a Navajo woman last year. Daniel Brown of St. John's, Arizona, accepted the job about a month after a vigil marked the one-year anniversary of the death of L'Oreal Sinajini, who was shot and killed during a suspected shoplifting in March 2016. The previous police chief retired in August. The officer who shot Sinajini did not face criminal charges and resigned in October. An independent review of the Winslow Police Department, released last month, found a pressing need for better training for new officers. The Arizona Republic reports incoming police chief Daniel Brown previously held leadership positions at the Gila River Tribal Police Department, the Navajo County Sheriff's Office, and the Maricopa Police Department. The biggest lake in Minneapolis is a step closer to having its name changed from that of a notoriously racist political figure to a traditional Dakota name. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reports the Minneapolis Park Board voted unanimously Wednesday to approve the Dakota name Bede-Mikaska. That replaces the name honoring John C. Calhoun, the 7th U.S. Vice President who defended slavery and played a large role in enacting the Indian Removal Act. This week's vote comes after years of local debate. In 2015, the Park Board settled on putting both names on the lake signage. The official change to Bede-Mikaska still has to get approved at the county, state, and federal levels. After a recent surge of criticism, a Native American-style totem pole will not be installed at the Oregon Country Fair. The fair board made its decision Monday night, KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The five-year project was long criticized by some as an act of cultural appropriation. The plan had been to raise the story pole in the Ritz Sauna and Showers area this summer. David Lewis is a cultural anthropologist and member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. He says the Haida-style pole isn't authentic, and is a case of white privilege trumping cultural sensitivity.
Pretty common as part of the hippie tradition or the New Age tradition. It's been the last 20, 30 years that Native people have been pushing back against that. I had suggested perhaps they brand it pretty well, interpret it pretty well, so people understood that it's actually a copy, or they actually work through the Haida tribe to maybe get some sort of exchange of that pole for another one from the tribe itself.
Several people with the Story Pole Project declined immediate comment. A Facebook group called Native Voices Against the Ritz Sauna Story Pole shared a statement thanking the fair board and calling the decision a turning point that'll make the event a better place, quote, for the 7th generation and beyond. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A Manitoba First Nation will soon return to their homes after their community was evacuated because of flooding 6 years ago. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the chief of the Lake St. Martin says his people were devastated by the evacuation and the years of living away from their homes.
More than 1,000 residents of the Lake St. Martin First Nation, about 120 miles northwest of Winnipeg, were forced to leave when the floods came 6 years ago. Many have been staying in hotels in Winnipeg. And the chief, Adrian Sinclair, says that was a difficult adjustment. More than 90 members of the band have died since 2011. Sinclair says there have been cases of suicides and homicides, but most of the victims died because of medical issues, illnesses related to stress because of the forced move. And he blames the government for ignoring the calls for help.
There should have been urgency right away, and they've seen the stats going up. It was in a state of emergency from day one, and I don't see why the government didn't see that.
When they do return to Lake St. Martin, residents will find a new school and water treatment facility. The first new pre-constructed homes are due to arrive in July. The new school, at a cost of $20 million, will open in the summer of 2018. It will have 25 classrooms, enough for more than 300 students, a hockey arena, soccer pitch, and baseball field. For many, a recent groundbreaking ceremony for the school was a sign that after 6 years, the people of this small First Nation would finally be able to soon go home. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. At BNSF, we move a ton of freight 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel. BNSF is proud to be a leader in protecting the environment. More at bnsf.com.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. So glad to have you with us on this beautiful afternoon. Spring has arrived. Looking ahead over the weekend, spring will stay with us. The forecast calls for sunny through Sunday with a chance of rain after 10 p.m. on Sunday night. So we appreciate that timing, bringing the big yellow ball to us on the weekend. Welcome to our first guest today, Kristen McTeague. She is Executive Director of the Healing Hand Foundation and Vice Chair George Reifenstein. They're here to talk about a brunch that will be held on Mother's Day, which is in about 10 days from today, to benefit Healing Hand. So first, George, please describe what Healing Hand is.
Well, Healing Hand is a charitable organization that is designed to meet unmet needs for Native health care. And we serve all of the communities that SEARCH serves in Southeast Alaska. And examples of unmet needs would be dentures, eyeglasses, hearing aids, some cosmetic surgery, travel. In some respects, things like a taxi fare, say if you land in Sitka to go to the Edgecombe Hospital and you need to get back and forth, or perhaps somebody who is here in town but has appointments at SEARCH every week but needs assistance with bus fare getting there, things like that.
To not be able to afford a pair of eyeglasses could be pretty serious for somebody. I'm surprised to hear that that is not part of the package of the health benefits that constitutionally the United States is obligated to provide to Indigenous peoples in this country. So I am interested to know that there are gaps. About how many individuals a year seek help from the Healing Hand Foundation? Kristen, maybe you can address that.
Sure. I've been at Healing Hand Foundation a little over 2 years, and we typically fund anywhere between 100 and 130 folks that live in Southeast Alaska every year. Sometimes it's a little bit more, sometimes it's a little bit less, but a little bit fewer, but in general we stay right around the 100, 115.
And I would bet there are folks within our communities up and down the Panhandle who have needs but don't know about Healing Hand. Do you do outreach in order to inform our various communities about this? And how does that work? How does somebody know about it, and then how do they connect with the services?
I work with the clinic directors of all the SEARCH clinics throughout Southeast and the 18 different communities that SEARCH serves. And we have Healing Hand brochures that talk about how to apply. We do have a website that is accessible. Anybody has access to the website, or to a computer, rather. And the website is hhf-ak.org. And applications are on the website. And SEARCH employees are usually available to assist. And if anybody needs assistance, I'm available as well.
Kristen, what's your phone number?
My phone number is 463-4402.
George, were you one of the founders of this organization, or can you give us a little bit of history about how it came to be? It's what, 6 years old now?
No, it's actually 15 or 16 years old. It was founded in 2001, and I actually was asked to join the board in 2002 when it was a year old.
Been on a long time.
Yes, it has been. And Joe Kaclan, who is the chair of the board and longtime chair of the board, it was a vision that he and Ethel Lund had to get to have something like this filled, you know, to try to, you know, add a little bit more to seeing that there were unmet needs that sometimes caused people not to get medical care. And what we've always done is provide, when the application is approved, it's for 80% of the funding, and then the recipient takes care of the other 20%.
You referred to Ethel Lund and Joe Coughlin. For those who don't know, very respected elders in our community. Ethel Lund was pivotal in the development of health services in the region for quite some time. Let's talk about the fundraiser on hand. It is Mother's Day, which is a week from Sunday. It is May 14th, and it's a brunch up at the top of Mount Roberts at the Timberline Restaurant. How can someone get connected with the event? Do they just show up at the tram, or how do the tickets work?
It's best if they, what we want them, would like them to do is to call down to the tram, and they can make their reservation, and it's going to run from 9:30 until 1:30, and so that's serving from 9:30 to 1:30, so we expect it'll probably end up a little after 2, but they'll call in and they can say what time they'd like to come, and on the reservation list they'll figure out that they have tables or not, or if not, suggest another time.
And the tickets are $50 for adults, $40 for those 18 and under, and it includes the ride up the mountain and presumably the ride down. So it's a good deal, because that's just about what a round-trip ticket costs up the mountain nowadays anyway. So we are talking with Kristen McTeague and George Reifenstein about the Healing Hand Foundation that assists Indigenous folks in our region with unmet medical needs, and the fundraiser on Mother's Day. It's a brunch beginning at 9:30, serving till 1:30, up at the top of Mount Roberts. So here's the number to call if you'd like to RSVP and make sure you've got a spot at that fundraiser brunch, 463-1339. That's 463-1339. I'm going to give you a few other details as well. If you are interested in knowing more about the Healing Hand Foundation, you can find them at hhf-ak.org, or call Kristen at 463-4402. Kristen, do you get inquiries ever about folks who want to just make a donation, or for those who maybe can't go to the brunch and want to be involved, what can they do?
Well, they can go to our website, and I just realized I gave you the wrong prefix for my phone number. It's 364.
Okay.
So now that I've said it three times, maybe everyone will remember, 364-4402. If you'd like to make a donation, you can send it to Attention Healing Hand Foundation at 3100 Channel Drive, Suite 300, which is Search's address.
Sure.
You can also log on to our website, and there's an option of giving a donation through PayPal, which is pretty simple. You just have to have your credit card handy, and it'll process it.
Sure.
And send me notification of your donation.
Anything you'd like to add?
Well, just that we are still in a period where any donations that are made will be matched by the Sea Alaska Sobolev Foundation Trust. And we've been very blessed to have had the support of Sea Alaska over the years to have funded $1 million. And of that, $500,000 of that came as matching for donations that we received. And it's been a boon to helping us have a secure future and to see that this good work goes on.
Do you have an annual goal for fundraising?
We do. This year our goal is $75,000, and that's a big reason we're doing this fundraiser. We're partnering with Gold Belt, and we're very thankful and appreciative of their partnership on this particular event, on the Mother's Day brunch. So any money that is raised through this particular fundraiser will be matched by the Sea Alaska Legacy Matching
Grant. Thank you to both Sea Alaska Foundation as well as to Gold Belt, and thanks to Healing Hand for making sure that more and more Southeast Alaskans are as healthy as they can be. Again, to RSVP on the Mother's Day brunch to support Healing Hand, 463-1339. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Lori.
Thank you, Lori.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 4th of May, 2017. It's the birthday of Agnes Faye Morgan, born Peoria, 1884, taught for many years at the University of California in Berkeley. She was an expert on nutrition, wrote more than 250 scientific papers, responsible for much of what we know about the vitamins in food. It's the birthday of the father of public education, Horace Mann, born in Franklin, Massachusetts, 1796, the man who said, "Education is our only political safety. Outside of this ark, all is deluge." He was self-educated, learned by reading books at his local library. He was accepted into Brown University, graduated in 3 years, valedictorian, and in 1837, when Massachusetts created the first board of education in the country, he was appointed secretary. Inspected all the schools in the state, gave lectures, talked about the benefits of a common school education, and he spearheaded the common school movement, promising all children a basic education funded by taxes. Peter Minuit landed on the island of Manhattan on this date in 1626. The Dutch had had a trading post on Governor's Island for a couple of years, and in 1625 they started building Fort Amsterdam on Manhattan. So Minuit arrived to find a small village already in place, more land being cleared. There were great stands of hickory, oak, and chestnut trees among the grasslands, the salt marshes of Manhattan. Times Square was a red maple swamp. A creek ran through Midtown. On the west side of the island, there was a cemetery, a small farm, an orchard, and two wealthy estates. Most of the houses were built along the East River. The main street was an old Indian path running from the southern tip of the island north to what is now City Hall Park. First, it was called Herestraat, Gentleman Street, but eventually it came to be known as Breedeweg, which became the name we know it by today, Broadway. Here's a poem for today by Carrie Shippers, Kindred Spirit. My father doesn't say ghost, though I know he's haunted. Instead, he says, when they let Uncle Marion out of that hospital, he didn't even move the same. He said they tried to take his stories. He loves his 15 uncles fiercely. Nearly all of them drank, did time in prison or mental hospitals, died before 40. When Marion was 20, a judge offered him the Navy or prison. He couldn't swim, so he ran away. Then prison or the army, marching hurt his feet. The third time he picked prison and was out in 6 months. I never liked to hear folks call him crazy. My father says he couldn't help how he was. What I know about my father tells me why he loves these men, the troubles they ran from and to, stories they lived without learning what they meant, and why he mourns. Each time my father had a choice, he chose the world he already knew, holding still till what he wanted looked like what he had. Kindred Spirit, a poem by Carrie Shippers from her collection Family Resemblances, published by University of New Mexico Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowners' reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this station comes from Zentropa Services, providing Juneau with general contracting services for projects big or small. A full list of services online at zentropa.jimdo.com or facebook.com/zentropa907.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Gorgeous day that it is. With me now is Eileen Hosey of Southeast Senior Services. She's been with that agency for 8 years, and we're going to talk about Tai Chi. So, first of all, the basics, a free class for seniors, meaning those who are 60 or over.
That's right.
Being offered. Yes. When does it start, Eileen?
It starts next Tuesday, May the 9th.
Okay. And that will be at the Filipino Community Hall, which is at 251 South Franklin.
Right.
What time is the class?
It's going to be 5:30 to 6:30, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it will run for 8 weeks.
Tuesday and Thursday mm-hmm. for 8 weeks. So I have a really basic question.
Yes.
What is Tai Chi, and why should anybody do it?
Well, Tai Chi has been around for about 2,500 years, and it's a series of integrated movements which increases your strength, flexibility, and perhaps most important of all, your balance. And so one of the major causes of injury for adults over the age of 60 is falling. I have some kind of dismal statistics here. Falls are the leading cause of death for people over the age of 65. More women than men fall, but more men die from falling than women, according to the statistics. 40% of the people hospitalized for hip fractures from falling are not able to return to independent living. The goal of Southeast Senior Services is to help seniors live at home independently and safely. Tai Chi has proven to be not only a meditative time, but a time to increase your strength, your flexibility, and your balance.
About how many people will be able to take this class? I assume there's a limit due to space.
Generally, we shoot between 15 and 20 people. That's the ideal, so that the instructor has time to devote to everyone. Right now, I have 9 people registered, and I have 3 applications out there.
So you maybe just have 3 or 4 more spots
right,
available.
Right.
And that, again, is Tuesday and Thursday evening, beginning next week, May 9th on Tuesday.
That's right.
From 5:30 to 6:30, and it'll be downtown at the Filipino Community Hall. Eileen, if somebody wants to sign up and they're hearing this and they're eager and they understand the benefits to them, what should they do? Where can they go or where can they call?
They can stop by the office. We're in the old St. Anne's Hospital building. My office is on the main floor. I won't be there, but I have a bin outside my office, the Caregiver Resource Center, with applications. You can fill out an application, slide it under the door. You can email me at my work address, and I will send you an application. We'll have a couple at the first class. In case you decide late, you can go to the first class, and our wonderful instructor, Josie Lynn Ferrer, will sign you up.
So a drop-in is okay?
At this point, it is,
Give it a shot.
I think so, yeah. When in doubt, call me on Tuesday, 463-6113. I'll have all the details worked out.
Yeah. We're talking with Eileen Hosey about free Tai Chi classes for those 60 and older. They start next Tuesday at the Filipino Community Hall. Did we say they're free?
We said they're free.
They're free. Yeah. You're welcome to give Eileen a call at the following number, 463-6113. And again, those classes start next week. There is a limit, but if you don't have a chance to register, drop by Tuesday evening a little bit before 5:30. The instructor will be there, and there may still be room for you. Thank you for sharing what Southeast Senior Services does.
You are welcome. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Shrikes are unapologetically, indisputably, absolutely cool with their neat black masks, elegant gray plumage, and predatory lifestyle. Technically, these little raptors are classified as songbirds, but to our ears, their song can sometimes sound less than appealing. Female shrikes obviously like it, though, and some other birds are drawn to it, too. Particularly, it seems, the small species that shrikes prey on in wintertime. 2 species of shrike, the loggerhead and the northern, are widespread in open areas of North America, where they sit patiently on wires and treetops, waiting for a bite, sometimes another bird. Scientific studies have shown that shrikes regularly lure these small birds within striking range with their song. In fact, some northern shrike songs include phrases that closely resemble the calls of some of their prey species, chickadees, sparrows, and other tender feathered morsels. It isn't clear whether these shrikes intentionally lure their quarry with song, but they certainly make the most of it when the opportunity comes along. You can hear more of the shrike songs and see videos when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Jazz and Classics lights up the evening with musical fireworks. Grammy winners Zool Bailey and Will Ransom with the showpieces for cello and piano. At the Jack, Tuesday, May 9th. At the Vega Quartet, Wednesday for Alaska Trout. Seafood, Schubert's beloved Trout Quintet, and more. And Thursday brings 3/5 of Beethoven, his 5th Quartet, 5th Cello Sonata, and the powerful 5th Symphony on piano forehand. Classic music, incredible musicians. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside, and jazzandclassics.org.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome to the studio Constance Stelzenmüller. Am I close? Thank you.
Awesome.
And Carl Broderson.
Oh, nailed it.
Is with the Juno World Affairs Council. And Constance is here to give a talk that is this evening at 5 o'clock, as always, at the KTOO studios here downstairs.
Yep.
So, Carl, what enabled Constance to come to Juno?
We are in partnership with the Anchorage World Affairs Council, which is technically the Alaska World Affairs Council, but we're still objecting to that in our own little way. No, the Alaska World Affairs Council brought her up, and she agreed to stop in Juneau and talk with us as well.
And Carl, you're a longtime board member. Are you currently chair of the World Affairs Council?
I happen to be president at the moment, yes.
But I know you've been involved for a long time,
yeah.
So thank you for that service. Constance, you work with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and your portfolio, as they may call it, is Europe. As we were chatting a little bit earlier, although you're German, Europe is much bigger than that. It
sure is
kind of the center of Europe, yeah. But Europe is a broad area. What's on fire in Europe right now?
God, how much time do we have?
Exactly. what should we as Americans
I'll
be paying close attention
to? I'll tell you what. It's not quite as much on fire as sometimes people seem to think. I always say, I'll explain that later. But in the main show, but basically the most important thing that's really burning on the front burner is the French elections, the second round of which is on Sunday, and where you have a centrist young man, a 39-year-old, who has very little governing experience, running on a sort of full-throated defense of liberal democracy and engagement with the world against a woman whom I think you can only fairly whom you can fairly define as somebody who's pretty close to fascism. So scary, somebody who wants to take France out of the European Union, who is anti-democratic, who has, you know, barely veiled racist views, etc.
So
you, as you can see, I am taking sides on this one. So I'm sorry.
Well, you're, I would guess, as an analyst, allowed to be a commentator as well. Brexit is moving forward. How do you see that impacting the European Union? When we speak of France, we must acknowledge Britain already has pulled the plug.
Absolutely. So I think very mixed views. I have to confess, I'm a Foreign Service brat. My father was in the German Foreign Service, and I spent my first childhood years in England. And when I heard the news of Brexit, I literally cried in the shower. It just really broke my heart. It's still breaking my heart. It's actually true for many of us, I think, because we think of Great Britain as a really important part of the European Union. It played a really important role in foreign policy and trade and lots of other things. And right now, one of the worst fears, of course, was that Brexit would bring after it a lot of other exits. That does not seem to have happened. If anything, there is kind of an opposite effect, that poll support for the EU is going up. The next question, of course, is how do we actually do this? And since no country has exited the EU before, we're kind of inventing this as we go along. And it's right now generating an awful lot of acrimony on both sides. And I personally think that this is going to be difficult for both continental Europe and for the for Great Britain. I think it's going to do a lot of damage. And I also worry that it's not going to achieve what the Brexiteers, the supporters of Brexit in the UK, said it would do, which is to make Britain more prosperous, more powerful, and more in control of things. I think that is going to is a bet that's going to fail.
Can you give our listeners an example of one or two ways that you think the European Union will be damaged by the departure of this strong member?
Yeah. Well, I think for Germans, the Brits were always really important as a big country in Europe with this very proud tradition of a sort of very forward-leaning security policy, the special relationship with America, and a really liberal free trade attitude. Which for Germany in particular was important because it was sort of opposed to the more statist, more protectionist attitude of the French. And it sometimes also helped us get out of our pacifist reticence as well. So having the Brits in on any major political operation was really important also because of the tremendous professionalism of their diplomats. And so that, I think, is just a huge loss. And I sort of, you know, the other thing that I sort of worry about is that I think that people, it is hard to understand, even for Europeans, just how deeply the EU is involved in their lives in ways that are actually benign rather than bad. And one thing's for sure, poor British regions were recipients of a lot of European development funds. That went into building a lot of roads, it went into agricultural subsidies, it went into tourism subsidies, and those things will be lost. And I think that people are only waking up to that fact now.
We are seeing certainly a wave of anti-globalist feeling, both in the United States as well as in Europe. A portion of that brought on, I think, through a degree of insecure feelings caused by migrant situation as well. And when people are frightened, they begin to look outward as to what are those threats and how are they related to why I don't feel safe. How do you see this wave of anti-globalist feeling affecting Europe?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's also something I plan to talk about tonight, because I think that is really something that's underlying so much of the populist politics that's roiling our political spaces, both on this side of the Atlantic and in Europe, where I come from. And I think, you know, it's certainly true that I think there was this perception that globalization and the integration that's brought about by communication technology and mobility that makes people, data, goods, and ideas mobile, that I think for a long time people like me, policy experts, thought that this would be good for everybody. It would just broaden out the middle class. It would bring growth and expanded knowledge and expanded opportunity to everybody. And I think we failed to see just that there were people who lost out from this. There were pockets of people who were excluded and disadvantaged, and that public policy was not taking care of this. I think that's a real grievance that needs to be addressed. But I think there is also a part of the sort of anti-globalist surge that is more problematic in that populist politicians seem to be promising that checking out, as it were, of globalization is A, possible, and B, will bring back more control, the states that are more in control of what they're supposed to do, that it will make people more in control. And I think that's a sort of a projection. I think that, you know, that part of our lives is not going to go away. And I think to try and pull up the drawbridges, as it were, to pull up the drawbridges of nations and communities will also cut off some of our lifeblood. Because exchange of ideas and goods and people is, I think, what also, you know, makes us grow and makes us, connects us to the world. And I think that could even be economically damaging.
The Syrian situation, the situation in Yemen, the situation in Far Eastern Africa, they're not improving, which will continue to drive an immigrant crisis to some degree in the continent that's closest to those areas, and that, of course, is Europe. What is the EU as a unified body able to do about immigration, or is it left to a country-by-country, state-by-state effort?
Well, that's another great question and one that we could spend a lot of time on. But let me put it this way. I think The unique thing about Europe, and that's sort of hard to understand for outsiders, is that it's really three things at the same time. It's nation states trying to grapple with this on a national level. There is an EU aspect to this, and then there's a NATO aspect as well. NATO, the transatlantic alliance, the security alliance. It's a minor aspect, but it's there as well. NATO has been supporting naval efforts to stop the people smuggling and control migration flows across the Mediterranean. It is not there as in as big a way as would technically be possible because some members of NATO in Europe don't want this to be a NATO operation. Also because partly for political reasons and also because NATO in some of Muslim countries or African countries has a bad reputation for a mixture of reasons. Deserved and undeserved. But the EU, I think, is for us sort of the political negotiating format for a lot of things. But my own country's chancellor, Angela Merkel, tried to get the EU to establish a Europe-wide sort of refugee distribution mechanism after we took in nearly a million Syrian refugees in the summer of 2015. And essentially, she failed because a number of countries said they weren't going to go along with this. So in the end, it's left to each country to decide how many per capita it would take in. And it's actually the Swedes who take in the most per capita. Then it's the Germans, and then sort of trickles down from there. But the most important part of this story is the EU-Turkey deal, by which we have – it's a sort of complicated arrangement – but which essentially sort of means that Turkey is willing to act as something of a safety valve for some of these refugee flows. And, of course, that's politically really tense because Turkey's leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is, changing the country's constitutional order in ways that are very concerning. They're illiberal, they're authoritarian. He's certainly moving away the country from the sort of democratic reforms that it had been undertaking as part of its efforts to join the EU, which are pretty much dead at this point.
We're talking with Constance Steljan-Mulla, hope I was close enough, who will be the speaker this evening here at KTO Studios downstairs on the topic Europe, America's Partner, or America's Program. She is being hosted by the Juno World Affairs Council. She is a scholar with the Brookings Institution, which is in Washington, D.C., and she's joined by Carl Brodersen, who is the current president of the World Affairs Council. Carl, I've completely ignored you. Constance has shared so much good information. What information?
Taking up your time, so sorry.
It's absolutely important that we talk about this. Carl, are there some details that you'd like to share that you want our audience to know about tonight's talk or any upcoming programs?
Don't let the unexpected marvelous weather deter you from coming out tonight. This should be an excellent opportunity and a great way to celebrate Star Wars Day.
And it is free, is that correct?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah,
Juno World Affairs Council programs are always free.
Yes.
So this is a chance to connect with a person who obviously carries a lot of important information. Constance, thank you for joining us. I was sharing that one reason I very much like volunteering on the show is I learn a lot, and I appreciate your sharing with us today your perspectives. You can hear Ms. Steljan-Mulla this evening, 5 o'clock at KTOO. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Healthy Smiles are here. On May 22nd, Search will open the doors to its updated and expanded Children's Dental Clinic. Staffed by board-certified pediatric dentists and outfitted with the latest in pediatric dental technology, the new clinic will provide your child with a lifetime of healthy smiles. All kids' smiles welcome, from the first tooth to 17 years old. Call 789-KIDS to make an appointment for your child today. This message brought to you by Search. Thank you.
And welcome back to a Juno afternoon. Lori Scandling here with you. Thanks for staying with us on this lovely day. My guest in this studio is Rick Caulfield. He is Chancellor in his second full year at the University of Alaska Southeast, which means for this weekend, three graduations in a row. Is that right?
It is a truly exciting weekend, Lori, and thank you for having us here. As Chancellor, I have the privilege of traveling to all three of our campuses, Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan, to celebrate the accomplishments of our graduates. And this year we have a total of about 650 individuals who will be receiving their degrees, master's degrees, baccalaureate degrees, associate degrees, certificates, workforce credentials. And tomorrow, on Friday, I travel to Sitka for our commencement event on the campus there at 7 p.m. And on Saturday, we'll be in Ketchikan, 2 p.m., to celebrate the accomplishments of our graduates there. And then the weather and Alaska Airlines willing, we'll be back in Juneau for our commencement here at 2 p.m. on Sunday afternoon at our recreation center, the Student Recreation Center at the Auk Lake campus.
It's always lovely to enjoy the capstone of one effort, one's efforts, and I'm sure that that's a joyous occasion that you get to see those excited people one by one come across the stage. So this year, as in the past, you have a Meritorious Service Award and a couple of honorary doctorates. Who are those folks?
We have two honorary doctorate recipients granted by the university's Board of Regents. In fact, I was here last week with one of those individuals, and many will know Lori Hagee, who is a distinguished music educator in our Juneau School District. She will be receiving an honorary doctorate for her accomplishments in bringing music to the lives of young children, not only here in Juneau, but she's recognized across Alaska and really nationally and even internationally for her work. The second recipient will be Ruth Demert from the community of Cake. She is a revered culture bearer in the Tlingit tradition, teacher of the Tlingit language and dance. So she will also be here. And then we have a Meritorious Service Award recipient, and that's Connie Monroe, who's been a longtime educator and advocate and activist in our community in many, many different sectors, in adult education. She's actually a recipient of an associate's degree way back when we had the Juneau Douglas Community College.
And GDCC.
She's gone on to do so much work in our community for the benefit of others.
What is the most common degree, if you can identify one, that is earned by a UAS grad?
There are two areas that are most prominent. One is teacher education. And, of course, that's an area that we're going to be taking on all the more on behalf of the entire University of Alaska system. And the second is in business administration and public administration. So we have quite a number of students who earn their degrees in accounting and also in human resources management and public administration, both a baccalaureate degree and a master's degree, a master's in public administration. And then in teacher ed, we, as you know, have a variety of options there, both at the bachelor's degree level in areas like elementary ed, special ed, and then a very popular Master of Arts in Teaching program, which is really a fast track for students wanting to complete their teaching certification. If they already have a bachelor's degree in English or math or what have you, they can come back, do an intensive summer course here in Juneau on our campus, beautiful time of year, and then go back into the schools and working under a mentor teacher, spend a year getting the skills they need to be effective classroom teachers and become certified in that manner.
What degree areas do you see disappearing with the continued budget cuts at the state level?
Well, we're a small institution. We've already made some cuts over the last 3 and 4 years, as you know. Probably the most notable is our Masters of Business Administration program, which we had in place for quite a while. But University of Alaska Anchorage and Fairbanks both have pretty robust MBA programs, and we decided instead to focus all the more on our Masters in Public Administration. We're in the state's capital here, and we have a number of faculty who have experience in public administration and also adjunct practitioners who teach for us. And so we made that decision some years ago. And there's a couple of other areas where the technology has changed. We used to have a computer information and office systems degree, and we've transitioned that into our Bachelor of Business Administration because the technology has changed, and people need to have more advanced skills, not just a two-year degree, but really a four-year degree to be effective in managing IT systems. So we've made changes of that nature over time. But with the budget cuts, which are part of our reality, we've worked hard to minimize the impact on our students. We are very pleased to actually be adding a Bachelor of Science in Fisheries, undergraduate fisheries. It's going before the Board of Regents in June for approval, and I think we'll get it. And that's in cooperation with the University of Alaska Fairbanks faculty, who are located here in Juneau as well. And we're also emphasizing Northwest Coast Arts. That's an area, in addition to our regular painting and drawing and sculpture, we're emphasizing Northwest Coast Arts, working in partnership with Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and the Institute of American Native Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So these are some things, even with the budget challenges we're facing, we're trying to be even more focused on things that are really appropriate for Southeast Alaska, and that includes fisheries, certainly marine biology, environmental science, and then programs like Northwest Coast Arts.
So one program I know that is relatively new and is being advertised is if you are not living in Alaska, but you're the grandchild, say, of an Alaskan, that you can come back and pay in-state tuition. Is that attracting more students?
It is. It's actually increasingly popular. And to your point, there are a number of individuals living outside of Alaska, often in Oregon or Washington, who have family members here in Alaska, a parent or a grandparent. And because of that relationship through our program, which is called Come Home Alaska, they can move back to Juneau. They can actually move back to Alaska, anywhere in the university system, and pay in-state tuition. And if you were to do that and enter into a baccalaureate program over a 3 or 4 year period, you might save $6,000 or $8,000 of in-state tuition versus what you would pay as an out-of-state student. So we're encouraging those who have family members who are thinking about coming back to Alaska. You know, if you think about it, our state needs young, bright, creative, energetic individuals, and to the extent that this encourages them to take a second look at the University of Alaska and move back to Juneau, Sitka, or Ketchikan, we think it's a great idea, and we're seeing a lot of response.
What should someone expect to pay on an annual basis for an in-state tuition as well as to survive, meaning some food and a room and some books?
Well, roughly speaking, tuition is about $6,000. And in saying that, we are still below the average cost for Western public universities. If you look at Montana, Idaho, Washington. So we think we're still affordable, even in providing quality programs. And then depending on if you're living with a family member or living at home, it's going to be a more modest amount, obviously. If you live on our campus and we have beautiful housing, it's probably another $12,000 total. So it might be $18,000 tuition and all of your expenses if you're living in a campus environment.
You mentioned that the total graduating class, whether it's a certificate or advanced degree, this year is about 650. Is mm-hmm. that more or less than previous years, say last year?
It's about the same as last year, but it's up significantly from, say, 10 years ago. If you look at the numbers, it's a significant improvement in, and it's all about trying to ensure that residents of Southeast Alaska and actually across the state are well prepared to step into the job opportunities that are out there. And a number of people in the state are retiring, and there are more opportunities there. So even with the budget challenges that we face as a state, and they're significant, I believe that if you have a post-secondary education, there are going to be good opportunities for young people. And I think the job market's going to become more competitive. And so those who have even any post-secondary education beyond high school, a welding certificate or a certified nurse aide, an accounting technician, that's going to give them a leg up for a position that over other applicants who may only have graduated from high school.
There's still a very strong and sustained correlation between the more you learn, the more you earn. That is still in place.
That's right.
What do you see as the greatest challenge, say, in the next 5 years? There's no question that Alaska's oil days are at a transition right now. Do you see it all about money, or what other challenges? For example, many universities now advertise we're all online. meaning their marketing understands that you have to reach students where they are. So talk a little bit about where you see the next 5 years.
Well, first of all, I think Alaska is going to need many more educated individuals post-high school. Again, whether it's a community college-like degree or a baccalaureate degree or beyond. So I think the 21st century is requiring people to have all the more education. I've been in a repair shop for heavy equipment, big trucks up north, and all of the mechanics working on those trucks are working with laptop computers. It's all online. It's scan tools. So even working on a Kenworth tractor trailer, you need an array of skills beyond high school. So Alaska is going to need that type of talent. And I think more and more students are looking for opportunities for flexible education. So at UAS, in fact, about half of the credits earned at our university are online. And so some of those classes are blended delivery where you'll have some students in front of an instructor, but also another group of students at a distance taking advantage of the same class. We have hybrid classes where in the past, in your grandmother's era of college education, you'd go to class 3 one-hour sections Monday, Wednesday, Friday in a week.
Maybe not our grandmothers, maybe ours.
Well, I'm dating myself just a little bit here. But instead today, if we can use all of the online tools that people can be online with their fellow students and their faculty members, and then when they do come together face-to-face, they can use that time not for a lecture that they could simply watch on television, but in fact for sustained engagement with their faculty members and their colleagues. So the way that people are learning and the way we're offering our programs is changing quite radically. And I think that's a good thing. I think people think about college and they think 18 to 24-year-olds. Well, in fact, the average student at the University of Alaska Southeast is 29. So it's very common for students who have raised a family or already started in a work environment to want to come back and to advance their education or complete a degree that they might not have completed in years past. So I think in fact, we're educating people today for jobs that we can't even imagine yet. If you think back 30 years of how technology has changed, even the existence of laptop computers 30 years ago was a very, very new thing. And so all of the jobs that are associated with IT today are dramatically different than they were 30 years ago. So we need to educate people not for a particular technology, but in fact for critical thinking skills, for an ability to work together with others in a diverse society, to be able to communicate effectively orally and in writing, and to have a professional disposition, showing up on time and being ready to work and willing to learn as you go. So those are the skill sets that we're trying to impart to our students at the University of Alaska. And I'll tell you, Laurie, you know, every time I get to sit down with students like we're going to honor this weekend, I am just thrilled because you see the quality of those individuals. Our student commencement speaker coming up this Sunday is Jo Marie Alba. She's originally from Ketchikan, born and raised. She is finishing her bachelor's degree in marine biology. She started out and earned an associate degree at our Ketchikan campus, decided she wanted to explore the world, and so she went off for 5 years and did other things. And now she came back to our Juneau campus. She's completing her bachelor's degree in marine biology, and she has an internship at Scripps Institute of Technology in California this summer and wants to go on to graduate school. And I'll tell you, she will knock your socks off. She's a terrific speaker. She's a very thoughtful person, and she's a great representative of a student born and raised here in Southeast Alaska. She's second generation. Her parents came from the Philippines. And you just see the talent that we have here in Southeast Alaska. And I'm really pleased that this weekend here in Juneau, 2 o'clock at our UAS Auk Lake campus, we get to recognize these terrific graduates who are going to go out and do great things in our state.
Well, congratulations to her and to you. We're talking with Rick Caulfield. He is in his second year as chancellor at the University of Alaska Southeast. Enjoy your 3 graduations this weekend. It's always a happy time. And thanks for being with us today, Rick.
Thanks, Laurie.
Support comes from Juneau Airport Shuttle, beginning May 15th, providing regularly scheduled service to and from the airport and 3 downtown locations, all flights every day. For more information and online booking, JuneauAirportShuttle.com.
Well, we're listening to the Congress, and they open the Juno Jazz and Classics 16-day series tomorrow night at the Elizabeth Paratrovich Hall. So come with your dancing shoes. We're looking to a wonderful, wonderful combination of jazz classics and, of course, the blues over the next a few days. With us is Nancy DeCherney from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, and she's got about a 3-page single space list of other things that are also happening. So we know about Juno Jazz and Classics. Tell us about some other fun activities that are happening in the next week.
This is kind of an epic weekend. It's First Friday. So we she says. Yes, and so because
and it'll be dry.
It'll be dry. It's going to be beautiful. Come down to the Arts Council and get the list. We have the little map. There's everything from over by the bridge at the bazaar. We have a fabulous show by David Riccio and a bunch of ceramicists that have done raku work. It's just beautiful.
His work is always stunning.
Yeah, and then they're going to have a ballroom dance afterwards because it's Cinco de Mayo. We've got... there is jewelry all over the place in the downtown area. The Alaska State Museum is having exhibits on decolonizing Alaska. There's Copa's got something called artist named Tito Chamorro. Aurora Project has a boutique pop-up. Hearthside Books is having a special. Annie Kales has Franklin Pierce, Heather Nichelle, who also makes jewelry. There's at the Walter Soboloff Center your opportunity to see the Alaska Native masks. Shoefly has Heather Dillon. Downtown Dames has Cassidy Thompson. I know Kindred Post is having Ishmael Hope's signing. The City Museum has a really interesting presentation about stories about stuff in their collection. Nell McConaughey and the Spiral Studio are out. Bustin' Out Boutique has a jewelry artist. The Barnaby Brewing is opening. That's in the old Arts Council basement. If you
aren't there like 16 breweries open just on Franklin Street?
Yes, exactly.
Time to check it out.
And Marms and Meeks will be opening their show there. So, and Marms and Meeks is Megan from my office.
Megan Garrison Chambers.
Chambers, as she's now known. but anyway, so it's First Friday. We have the Dipstick Car Show happening. We have a Maritime Festival happening. We have...
And that's primarily Saturday down at the waterfront.
Yes. Also on Friday, there's a book signing by Joe Carson at Rainy Retreat. Barrels, Bottles, and Kegs at the Narrows at the Chamber of Commerce. As I mentioned, there was the ballroom dance, and there's the Congress Dance Party. And the Blues Cruise comes up on Saturday. It's just, I think...
What an amazing weekend.
This
spring
is crazy.
Has arrived.
Oh, it's nuts. There's races. There's a drag show. You just need to go onto our website.
JAHC.org. And you'll see the millions of things that there are to do.
It's crazy talk.
Well, thanks for joining us on a Juno afternoon.
We'll see you.
Jeff is giving us the goodbye signal. So thank you for being with us.
We'll see you at Sunday.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220B.